When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey guys, it's Sean O'Connell, the managing editor at CinemaBlend and a co-host of the Real Blend podcast. And as you can tell, if you're watching us on the YouTube channel, I am in a different location. It is San Diego Comic-Con and I'm in Southern California as part of the CinemaBlend team to cover everything that's going on here at SDCC 2024. So make sure you're following along with all of our coverage. If you're an audio listener, you might notice that I sound a little bit differently. I'm in a giant room that Gabe has been working really hard with the CinemaBlend video team to set up. It's going to bring amazing content to you guys on CinemaBlend and on our YouTube channel and all of our socials, all the stuff they're going to be grabbing while we're here at San Diego. So because of the fact that I'm here, the boys are traveling, we're coming off the Deadpool and Wolverine world premiere. Hopefully you guys got a chance to check out some of our coverage from that. But we wanted to make sure you guys still had some sort of Real Blend you guys can listen to this week. Not a full original show, but a classic interview that we wanted to finally get onto this channel for the very first time. And where else do we start but the first time that we got a chance to sit down with Quentin Tarantino, the legend and the friend of the show. This is the 20-minute interview that we did with Quentin on behalf of his most recent film now at this point, the film that we're waiting to see what he's going to follow up with, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. We ended up getting 20 minutes with Quentin on behalf of the film, and we wanted to bring our A game, try to win him over, see what we could do in terms of getting him to be a friend of the show. And so here's, without further ado, a vintage episode, an interview with Quentin Tarantino, the first time he sat down with the Real Blend podcast.
I want to nerd out with you about Robert Richardson and his brilliant cinematography. Yeah. You shoot on 8mm, 16mm, 35mm. Yeah. You have these awesome aspect ratio changes when we get to the gun. It's so cool watching the Bounty Law stuff. Yeah. Talk about those formats and what it was like to shoot on those formats and those aspect ratio changes.
Well, that's a really good question. And it's one of those things where naturally, when it comes to what you're referring to is the fact that Rick Dalton is an actor in this movie, and he had a TV show. And so you see a lot of the media that he created. Yeah. You know, so you see a bit of a show, you see him in this movie and that movie. Naturally, me being me, I'm so ridiculously invested in the media on media of the movie, almost even more than I am to the soul of what the true story is supposed to be. So it's like naturally, I probably had like the most fun shooting the Bounty Law moment.
Yes, right. I knew you did.
Yeah,
that's 16. That's 16. Yeah. That was 16.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it was 16. And then we also with the Bounty Law sequence, we actually just used a little clip of it. But I shot the whole opening bumper for Bounty Law. There exists the entire opening scene. All right, leading into the show bumper, and I can tell you, it looks ridiculously authentic. I mean, it looks like a late 50s show. Yeah. I was very, very happy with it. But that was just so much fun. Being on that, we had our Western town for Lancer. That was our Western town for Bounty Law. We shot not only that, we had to do it all in a day. So we had to do the entire sequence in a day, but then also all that stuff that we shot for the promo. Yeah, that starts the movie.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And we did something like about like 40 setups that day. And Leo was busting his ass running from here to there. And it just so happened to be the hottest day of the year that day. So Leo was sweating balls.
And you feel free to curse. You can curse on the podcast. Okay. Yeah.
So this is an amazing car movie. Just driving around LA.
Oh, the
car culture of LA. So in doing that, you have to recreate 60s LA.
Yeah.
So I'm really curious, is when you did location scouting to shoot on practical sets, how much of 60s LA is still found here in contemporary, in the contemporary city?
There's a bit. There's a bit. What you got to do, you pick a place that you have a good idea of what it looked like in 1969. Like, for instance, just to give you an example, a lot of Quinn Martin shows that were based out of Warner Brothers Studios shot a lot in the valley, so they didn't have to drive around that much. Mm-hmm. So like the FBI all the time, all of a sudden they're just on Riverside Drive.
Right.
And so you can like, oh, okay. So you look at it and you say, oh, okay. So this is still fairly similar to what it was like. We got to do something about that. We got to do something about that. And that used to be this, and now it's that. But the structure of the building is still the same. I could paint it, and it would be like it was. And then you go start driving the blocks. Yeah. All right. So, and obviously you're picking out a block that doesn't have a whole lot of modern stuff around. But okay, so this looks good this way down here. Well, now let's just start driving. And how many bogeys do we see? Yeah. All right. That like absolutely won't work. And then you find a place that has one or two or even three blocks that go together. And the trick is to finding one. You'd love it to have some things that have some cool things from the 60s there. The trick is just not having anything bad there.
Sure, right.
Or nothing bad that you can't camouflage to some degree or another. You know, so it's like, you know, oh, okay, that one street looks great. I can build an entire scene. We can add all this stuff if I'm just looking this way. But when you're talking about Brad driving, I've got to be able to cover three or four blocks.
When he's on the highway,
oh my God,
and
there's
and it's a long shot on the highway, and all the cars are old.
Yeah.
I don't know
even
how
the cars
you pulled that
the
shot off.
Way.
No. That's one. Well, no, in that instance, no. That's us shutting down the shutting down the freeway.
Yeah. Right.
Like you do.
Yeah. No, when he turns onto the Hollywood freeway with the girl. I mean, no, that is like we own the Hollywood freeway for an hour.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, and I like the shot that goes up over the drive-in.
Oh,
that shot is devastatingly beautiful.
Yeah. And that was, you know, and then that drive-in's not there anymore, so we did that with miniatures.
Oh, did you really? Get out of here.
What?
Yeah, what we did is, okay, so it's like, we found the space, the marquee was real.
Right.
And we had a frame for how big, just a frame for how big the drive-in screen would be.
Okay.
And so he really drove. And he turned and he turned and he went around this way. And then the camera moved up towards this kind of frame. All right. Then John Dykstra, the great John Dykstra.
Yes.
All right. Built a miniature of the drive-in screen. And me being me. Okay. So when we get over the drive-in screen, I don't want CGI cars. I want toy cars.
Okay.
I want physical toy cars.
Like Matchbox cars?
Yeah, well, cars that can move a little bit, but a physical, like this is a physical wallet I'm holding in my hand.
What does it say on it? Yeah.
A physical car. Yeah. All right, as opposed to a graphic car.
Yeah.
And he goes, well, that could get kind of expensive and no one's going to notice the difference. And I go, I'll notice the difference. And come on, John's. So will you.
That's good.
Okay. I go, how expensive? Okay, you don't break the bank of Monte Carlo, but I mean, I think it's worth it. And then, so then he comes back and you go, well, okay, if we're going to do that, we have to have at least two cars moving a little bit. All right. You know, but that doesn't feel like cheating. Doing miniatures, that's in Sarah Honda, all right? That's not cheating. That's actually doing it cooler.
In camera, practical effects, man.
Of course.
It's crazy to me to think that Pulp Fiction turns 25 this year. We were literally just watching it in this room on that TV before you walked in. I'm curious, when you hear Pulp Fiction is 25, what's the first thing you think of? And did you learn anything making that movie that you used on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Well, with Pulp Fiction turning 25, everyone wants me to get all reminiscy about it. And I'm kind of in the middle of this movie now. So I'm just not in a, let me think back to those days. Gone are the days. It's an interesting question. Did I learn anything? No gigantic lesson that I can think of that I learned then and I applied here. But I was learning a lot because I still didn't really know how to make a movie when I was doing Pulp Fiction. By the time I had done Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction and started Jackie Brown, I thought, okay, I think I kind of know what I'm doing now. But there I'm still kind of learning what time it is.
Right.
And that's the movie that came out of you kind of knowing what you're doing, which blows my mind.
Well, I knew how to write, and I kind of knew how I wanted to direct the movie and how I wanted the movie to look. But just even, like, you know, protocol on a set, all right. that stuff I was still learning.
Wow. Sure. Let Quentin enjoy a drink.
Yeah, yeah, yes. Enjoy your drink. Yeah, we're drinking, I guess, amusing margaritas. No, not a sponsor, by the way. So this is actually a question I was going to ask you that I kind of got an answer by accident earlier mm-hmm. when I ran into, randomly, Margot Robbie in the elevator as I was going up. One of my favorite scenes in the film is when Sharon Tate yeah. goes to watch her film,
yeah, yeah,
and she shows up at the theater. She tells them, "I'm in the movie." They don't believe her. And then the guy lets her in. It's a really cool moment. Yeah. For people out there who haven't seen the movie, it's a great sequence. And she's actually watching the real
Sharon Tate. Yeah.
So I wanted to know if that ever happened to you. And Margot told me that it actually happened on True Romance to you. And I was wondering, can you walk me through what it was like to sit in the theater in a public mm-hmm. screening, mm-hmm. not a premiere,
yeah, 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 yeah.
and listen to people react to your movie?
Well, that wasn't the first time. I mean, when Reservoir Dogs, forget about before Reservoir Dogs opened. I spent a year going on the film festival circuit with Reservoir Dogs. So I watched it in all those festival screenings. And then, I pretty much saw Reservoir Dogs every other day for the whole 4 weeks it played in Los Angeles. But what you're talking about is it. Not only did that happen to me where, hey, I wrote this, all right? It was True Romance, and it was at The Bruin.
Okay. The theater you shot that scene at?
Yes, exactly.
What?
I was on a date, and True Romance was playing at The Bruin. I go, hey, let's go see True Romance. Okay. And so we go to the theater, and then I'm just getting ready to pay, and I think, well, I wrote this. My name's on the poster.
Did your date know that you?
Yeah. She knows I wrote it.
Just making sure.
I imagine Quentin sitting in a theater with his date going, this Walk and Hopper scene coming up?
Yeah.
Greatest dialogue ever written. Are you ready for this?
Yeah. And so I go to the manager. Look, I wrote this. How do I know you wrote it? All right. You know, so we start talking, and and actually, my date is the one that starts kind of getting into it with him.
Oh, really?
Wow. And so she's arguing with him. Meanwhile, like, some people recognize me from Reservoir yeah. Dogs, okay. and they come up and they ask for my autographs. And so, like, so I'm off to the side while she's fighting with the manager, and I'm signing the autographs. And then all of a sudden, the manager looks up, and who are these people? She goes, oh, they're his fans.
They're Mr. Brown fans.
Give him a ticket.
He's signing autographs in front of your theater because he has fans.
Let him in.
Is it crazy listening to people react to your movies?
What?
Is it crazy listening to people react to your films?
It's great is what it is. I mean, it's a payoff for me because throughout the whole experience, when I'm writing the movie, I'm hearing laughs. When I'm editing the movie, when I'm shooting the movie, I'm hearing laughs. When I'm editing the movie, I'm hearing laughs. But I'm not hearing laughs. It's just where they should be. And so there is this payoff when I finally go to the movies is like, and I watch it with an audience, I'm finally getting the real laughs. This is the payday for me. This is what it's all been about. And that's why, like, for, like, you know, the first 3 weeks of the movie, I'm just constantly seeing it all the time because I'm never going to have this audience again. True. I'll have other retrospective audiences, but that first audience of just seeing it.
Do you still sneak in to theaters?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Yeah, wow. The whole opening weekend, I'm just all over Los Angeles seeing it. Okay, let me see what's like. What's going on in Torrance. Okay.
So we all know what we're doing opening weekend. We're just going to go to a bunch of theaters. Yeah.
Well, the line we've been using the most is, he said he's the devil and he's going to do some
devil shit.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's not verbatim, but.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah. I'm very curious about your approach to writing when a character is a real person versus a character that you created.
Yeah, yeah.
And your approach to that, how different it is. And specifically, I want you to talk about getting a chance to write dialogue for Bruce Lee. And potentially, did you feel like you were directing Bruce Lee at any point?
Well, Mike did such a good job playing Bruce Lee that I did feel like I was directing Bruce Lee from for a bit. Well, in any of those situations, like in the case of both Sharon and Bruce and Steve McQueen, I did a lot of research on them. I did read a lot about them, and I think I captured a big part of it. I'm not saying that that version of Bruce Lee is the be all end all right, is everything the man is, but from everything I've heard, he was quite arrogant, you know. And then and even the things I had him bring up are things that I'd heard him say in one way or another before. Same thing with like the kids in the killer car, you know. A lot of the things they said, they were my words, but I'd heard them say things like that, and so I you know, steered it in a different direction. But it's taken from actual things that they had said.
Now choreographing him in that scene, though, talk about just because
it was one shot, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh my gosh!
And that's it's just incredible to me to think about. Like, did you instructing him to sort of act like Bruce, or did he just nail? He had it when he came.
Well, he knew he was playing Bruce Lee. Everything, you know, and so. It was the only thing was the fact that Bruce Lee had actually a very thick Hong Kong accent.
Okay.
You know, so he had to hit the Hong Kong accent, you know, or else you're just not Bruce Lee.
Right.
You know, and he did a really, really good job with it. But he was just terrific. I think he'd been waiting to play Bruce Lee his whole life, you know, and he just killed it. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't be happier. But also I needed an actor who could, one, be Bruce Lee and do a terrific job with it, but he had to be able to do the fights well, and he had to be able to pull off the one take shot. Yeah. No, but that's fun to actually work out this big, you know, starts out as a close up and you know, a whole big fight is going to develop and trying to do it all on a crane.
It was a little bit in before you leaned over and said, "This is one shot." And I went, "Holy shit."
One of my favorite shots you ever did is in Pulp Fiction when they show up at the door of Brett's place.
Yeah.
And then you stay at the doorway and then they walk down, have the foot massage conversation.
Yeah.
We're just chilling in the hallway.
Yeah.
And that was like one shot. Right, go ahead, Jake. Sorry.
Mike's actually coming on my show in studio in Chicago next week. So I'm excited to get to. I'm going to play some of this audio for him to hear. There's a great scene in the movie between Timothy Olyphant, who is fantastic, and Leonardo DiCaprio.
God, he's so good.
Where they talk about the roles, kind of the roles that got away.
Yeah.
And as fans of yours over the years, we've heard a lot of like rumored Tarantino movies that were going to happen. Yeah. They just, for one reason or another, didn't come to fruition. The one that always fascinated me was the Vega brothers.
Yeah, Double V Vega.
Yes. I'm curious, how far into that, do you know what the plot was going to be? How far into that process of planning that movie did you get?
Yeah, that's the only thing I did know.
Yeah,
was the premise per se. I don't think I took it far enough for a story, but I had a premise. It would have taken place in Amsterdam.
Oh my God!
So it would have been during the time that Vincent was in Amsterdam
because the car scene in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh
my
God!
Yeah, I remember in Pulp Fiction, he's just come back from Amsterdam. Yeah. And he's telling the whole story and everything.
With mayonnaise on the fries.
Yeah, and it was like, you know, he was running some club for Marcellus in Amsterdam.
Right.
And so he was probably there for like a couple of years, and so at some point. In his 2-year stay in Amsterdam running some club, Vic shows up to visit him. And it would have been their weekend.
Oh my God.
That would have been
exactly
amazing.
What happens to them or what kind of trouble they get into. I never took it that far.
Yeah. Right.
But it definitely would have took place in Amsterdam and it would have been Vic visiting him.
I would pay $1,000 to watch that. and the whole bloody affair.
The ability now. I mean, Martin Scorsese is doing like the
Irishman.
I don't think so.
Fair enough.
There is the shelf life.
Okay. Fair enough.
But something I've always wanted to ask you is Amanda Plummer's mouth stopping in Pulp Fiction when she says her line. Mm-hmm. So I know it's a loaded question, but opening wise, but why do you stop her mouth?
If I'm not mistaken, I think it's about the first beat in Mr. Lou happening on a freeze frame.
Yes.
All right. Wow. So it's like, it's like if she finished the line, then I'd have to freeze it during the opening beat. If I stopped it just a beat before the opening of the song, then it can be in a full-on freeze, and then the Miramax title can come up at just the right time. So it was a timing thing about it getting stopped just that nanosecond before.
Your film openings are something that I always wait for. I'm always like, you think about Reservoir Dogs, like a virgin circle shot around the table. You think Pulp Fiction. You think them at the diner. You think bastards, the milk, I mean, everything's amazing. I was curious for you as a writer, when you write your scripts, is the opening always what you write it as the opening? Or do you, like, have you ever written a script and then had a dialogue moment that you went, you know what, this would serve better as an opening moment, not a mid-sequence?
No, I never had a scene where, did I? No, I don't think I ever did. I switched an opening. I guess that's not true. I guess I did it once because I had to do two new openings for Kill Bill. So if Kill Bill had been one movie, it would have started with the bride driving.
Right.
You know, like she does in Kill Bill 2 and saying, okay, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And when I get there, I'm going to kill Bill.
We still think Kill Bill's one movie, though.
Yeah, I do too. I do
no,
too.
No. Hold on. We're going to get to that.
That's later in the show.
I do think of it as one movie, too, but I still had to open both movies.
Right.
But then I came up with that idea that I ended up loving of just having the blackness and then, like, little by little bringing up the silhouette.
Yeah.
Of her laying down on the floor.
Yeah. We're going to get to that, believe me, because that is a great topic on the show. There's so much talk, and I'm sure you're exhausted about hearing it, about you're going to make 10 movies, you know, and it's a finite number. Yeah. Then a story comes along, and it says he's got a great Star Trek script, right? And he may do that. Mm. Do you ever think about, like, well, I might not do the Star Trek script because I don't want it to be my 10th movie, you know? Like, I'd want my 10th movie to be as original as all the films that you've done up to this point. And getting into a franchise, while that might be fun to play in that sandbox, you know, it might prevent you from doing it, or maybe you do that and then do another one. Like, what are your thoughts on just when a project comes around that interests you, oh, I can't do that because I'm thinking about getting out?
Well, you know, there's actually nothing wrong with thinking... I don't know if I want to do this one because the next one needs to be really great. You know, it's like, you know, that's almost the point of doing 10 movies is, you know, I'm never doing a job. I'm always doing it for the right thing. Everything is as important as it should be.
Sure.
You know, and how all that's going to work out, I don't know. I mean, like, I guess I do have a loophole if the idea was to throw a loophole into it.
Sure.
All right. Which would be, you know, well, I guess Star Trek doesn't count. All right. I could do Star Trek, and then
because it's your rule.
But you naturally, yes, it. Yeah. But naturally, I would end on original.
Yeah.
But the idea of doing 10 isn't to come up with a loophole. I actually think if I was going to do Star Trek, I should commit to it. All right, it's my last movie. All right,
sure.
It's not a should be nothing left-handed about it. I don't know if I'm going to do that, but that might happen. And there also is another thought process going on where it's like, yes, it could be original. On the other hand, look, you know, maybe that could show a different career I could have had. All right, where it's like maybe this is my last original. I'm not saying this is the case, but maybe this is my last original, and Star Trek or any other thing, a book or something like this is the career I could have had if I wasn't just writing everything all the time, writing always originals. Maybe I would have had a different career if I looked for other people's scripts, or if I wanted to find a book to be inspired by,
like, and do
a
punch,
do an adaptation of that. Would have been a different career. Maybe that could be fun to explore on the 10th. I don't know. I'm making all this up as I go along.
Sure.
But those are two different ways I could look at it.
Okay.
He's going to say something to you real fast, but I want to know if you could cast Rick Dalton in one of your movies, what would it have been?
Oh, that's a good question. Let me think. I definitely could have been one of the guys in Reservoir Dogs. All right, yeah,
for sure. All right, go real quick.
Okay, we're running out of time. We want to thank you so much for joining the Rebel End Podcast. This has truly been one of the most amazing things in the world.
Yeah.
There is a debate.
Thank you guys for coming down here.
Oh, my God.
Are you kidding me? It's amazing.
There's a debate that has literally started from like day one of this podcast, and it's about Kill Bill. How I believe that it's two films, because there is an end credits and an opening credits to the movie. These boys both believe that it's one, so I'd like you to tell me why I'm wrong.
Okay.
This trailer is for one movie, by the way.
Yes, okay.
I understand, but I can buy volume two if I want to.
Yes, technically you are correct, because we released it as two movies, and there is a closing and an open credits, all right? But since I made it as one movie and I wrote it as one movie, that's just some shoshannery that I did in editing. Now it works really good that way.
Yes.
And frankly, the truth of the matter is, I don't think it would have been as popular as a 4-hour movie. Right. All right. I literally had a guy say that to me. You know, he, it was like, it was one of those weird diamond bullets. Every time somebody says something to you, every once in a while somebody says something to you, that, okay, I can't unhear that. And he goes, look, Quentin, here's the thing, man. My Uncle Artie would love this movie. I mean, he would love it. He wouldn't love it at 4 hours.
That's amazing. I need to see the whole body of Ferris.
We show it from time to time. At the end, we're like, if you're going to come down to whatever. When we show it, we usually show it for a week.
Saw this in 35. I'll watch everything in 35, man. That's all I care about.
All right, you're being rushed. Yeah. So thank you so much for your time. This is
amazing. Oh, are you kidding me?
For this one in particular, we really need to thank our friends at Sony Entertainment, who put Quentin on our show, took a chance on us, the Real Blend podcast, and knew that Quentin was looking for something long form, and that he'd be able to sit down and talk about not just this film, but all of his films. And then it went so well that Quentin's been on the show 3 other times. Make sure you go listen to those interviews with Quentin Tarantino as a guest on the Real Blend podcast. The cool thing about this episode dropping on Friday is that it is the anniversary of the release of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. 5 years. I cannot believe that's how much time has passed since that movie came out. Kind of thought we'd have another Quentin Tarantino film to talk about up until this point in those 5 years. But given the fact that it potentially might be his last film, I'm definitely not rushing it. I want to make sure that he puts out something that we love and that puts a perfect cap on his 10 film run. My headspace is in San Diego. I'm looking forward to Comic-Con. I'm looking forward to bringing you guys a ton of great coverage. And of course, we got plenty more Real Blend coming up with a lot more great interviews. One that's in the bag. I can tease out M. Night Shyamalan came on the show. We're going to be talking about Trap when that comes around and a few more that we have in the works. So keep it right here on Real Blend. Hit subscribe if you're on the YouTube channel. Tell a friend about the show. Spread the word of Real Blend. And we'll see you back here with a brand new episode very, very soon.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.